Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We've been following the Gospel of St. Luke, and we'll continue with Luke today. Chapter 15, verses 1 to 3 and 11 to 32. Basically, it's what we have come to call the parable of the prodigal son. But there's a lot of structural issues around this gospel which make it perhaps even more interesting than just the story of the wayward young son, that somehow or other Jesus is putting this very much into a context of a response to a great deal of the criticism that he has received, and he receives at the very beginning of this gospel. For it begins by saying the tax collectors and the sinners were all seeking the company of Jesus to hear what he had to say. And the Pharisees and the scribes complained. This man, they said, welcomes sinners and eats with them. So he spoke this parable to them. So the scribes and the Pharisees are, of course, as they are portrayed in the Gospels often, and it's never a totally inclusive kind of nomenclature that the Gospel uses. Not all of the scribes and not all of the Pharisees were the people that they are portrayed to be in the Gospel, but obviously some were, and those are the ones that Jesus addresses. It's a problem in the Gospels, and particularly in the Gospel of John. I know that I've had people say to me in the Gospel of John that the Gospel of John is anti-Semitic, which is a strange kind of accusation, since Jesus, the Blessed Mother, and the author of the Gospel, according to John, are Jewish as well. But John does do what Luke does in this case and what Jesus does often. He uses the name of a whole group to identify the few in it who are in opposition to Jesus, so that when Jesus says the scribes and the Pharisees, or when the Gospels say the scribes and the Pharisees, it's not an inclusive term. And when John uses the word the Jews, it's not an inclusive term. It's a term to identify those who are opposed to Jesus, oftentimes the leadership of the community, and not only the high priest, but also the layers of rabbinic society which surround the Sanhedrin, the central governing body of Judaism in the first century. So that we have to be careful, because Jesus himself was considered by many of his age to be a Pharisee. And that doesn't mean to be a hypocrite. It means to be someone who took that particular approach to the interpretation of the Hebrew Scriptures, the one who was familiar with all the glosses and the Talmud and all of those kind of ancillary documents that go along with the Hebrew hermeneutic, the Hebrew exegesis of the Scriptures of what we call the Old Testament. So what we have then is a group of Pharisees and a group of scribes who are feigning scandal because Jesus is surrounded by tax collectors and sinners. And he doesn't seem in any way to reject them. In fact, as they say, he even eats with them and welcomes them. So Jesus, in the light of this, then, and here we have a structure, a setup. It's really kind of interesting. We have a structure, we have a setup of for whom did the ministers of the covenant exist? Were they only to care for those who were observant? Or might it not have been their task to bring the truth of the law and the power of the law into the lives of people who were not observant? It's the same way. And one of the problems that we face within Catholicism is with the way that we're structured today is the task of the priest, for instance, simply to minister to the saved, or should we in some way, shape, or form be open to include those in our life and in our life and activity who are distant from the faith or who do not know the faith? Must we avoid everyone who is not a regular churchgoer? I think that some people think that we should, and they find it difficult when we decide to associate or affiliate with others who they do not see as really greatly observant Catholics. And yet that's the problem the Pharisees and the scribes had. How dare you associate with those who are not basically observers of the law, and in a kind of unwritten kind of insinuation, who therefore are not willing to be totally obedient to us. And I think that goes across the board. But the parable is, a man had two sons, and we know the story. The younger son said to his father, "Father, let me have the share of the inheritance that would come to me." Here is the father's first sign of indulgence toward his son. He has no obligation to give the son his share. It is an inheritance, and the son should receive only at the death of the father. According to the law, it should be a third of the father's estate, and we get the idea that the father was a very wealthy man. And so the father did what he asked, and he gave him his money. And the son, of course, went to a distant country where he squandered the money on a life of debauchery. And when he had spent it all, that country experienced a severe famine, and now he began to feel the pinch. So he hired himself out to one of the local inhabitants, who put him on his farm to feed the pigs. Certainly the most denigrating position that an observant Jew could possibly be assigned to, since, of course, pork was unclean. And he would willingly have filled his belly with the husks that the pigs were eating, but no one even offered him anything. And so he came to his senses and says, "How many of my father's paid servants have more food than they want? And here I am dying of hunger. I will leave this place and go to my father and say, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I no longer deserve to be called your son. Treat me as one of your paid servants.' So he left the place and went back to his father." The story of sin and repentance is summed up in this simple paragraph of the gospel, that having received the indulgence of the Father for us, the indulgence in the care of the living God, the extravagance of his availability to us, the extravagance of his presence within us and among our communities, the proliferation of the opportunities to come into his personal presence in the tabernacles of our churches. And yet many say, "Well, this is not enough for me. It isn't, you know, I can't hold enough hands this way, or I can't, you know, express my jubilation this way, or I don't feel, you know, I can't come to him without, you know, a whole gaggle of supporters whom I call my community," all of that kind of thing. All of that kind of, or the ones who say, "I'm tired of it, it's irrelevant, I'm going off and live my life as I choose." All of those are relevant to the decision that the son made, and he made it only because the father was so extravagantly good for it to him. If, in fact, in our day and age, we were persecuted and we had rare opportunities to come into the presence of the Lord, if we did not have all the proliferation of churches and clergy and so forth that we have, and so the real presence would not be available to us or present to us, we might actually find that we appreciated it more. But it's the whole thing, once again, of familiarity brings contempt. This is just too normal. This is just too easy. This is just the way it is. And so we're going to go off and we're going to do exactly what we want. We'll do exactly what we want in worship. We'll do exactly what we want in our moral lives. We'll do exactly what we want in our emotional lives. And so who cares? But then, ultimately, these things do crash and burn. Whether they crash and burn during the lifetime of the dissident, whether they crash and burn during the lifetime of the one who turns away from the Lord, certainly when it comes time to die, these things become in some way, shape, or form haunting memories within us and a haunting presence within us. And hopefully, part of the salvation that the Lord gives us is the awareness of this at the moment of death, and the awareness, and therefore a sincere and authentic repentance for the lives that we have lived. Since we don't know this, and since there is no possible way to know this, what happens to us then is that we have to withhold judgment. The Council of Trent tells us that. Who knows what the last second, the last moment of a person's life was as they really encounter the finality of life and they really encounter the absolute certainty and presence of death. We don't know that. And so Trent says we may never judge the ultimate disposition of any human soul. We do canonize saints only because the Lord manifests to us that they are in heaven through the working of miracles. But such is the story of the Son. The one who has found out the world he has chosen is an empty world. The one who has found out that the world he has chosen is a world in which there is no authentic friendship, in which there is no authentic love, which there is only since he is exploiting the world in which he lives, the world in which he lives exploits him. And we find that as a constant dynamic within the contemporary society. For those who decide to leave the presence of the Lord and exploit the world in which they live will find out in the end that the world also has exploited them, and that in the end they have gained very little. So he returns to the Father, having practiced his act of contrition, as it were. And while he is still a long way off, the Father sees him and moved with pity, runs to him, kisses him. The Son begins the confession, but the Father doesn't even wait. He just says, quick, bring the best robe, put it on it, put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the calf we have been fattening and kill it. We are going to have a feast, a celebration, because this son of mine was dead and has come back to life. He was lost and he is found. And so they began the celebration. An interesting thing of this is that this falls in Luke's gospel following two other shorter parables, one the parable of the lost sheep and one the parable of the lost coin. In both cases, someone goes astray, someone leaves. The coin falls out of the collection that the woman has, and the sheep wanders off. And of course, for the sheep to wander off in the desert is almost a sure death sentence, for the wild beasts of the desert would certainly devour it very quickly. And so the shepherd goes and finds it, rejoices. The woman sweeps the house and finds it and rejoices. That there is great rejoicing over that which was lost and is found. Now, this parable makes that even more dramatic because it takes it out of the animal and the material world and it puts it into the world of human relationships. And that world of human relationships is, of course, incredibly important for us because, as we have seen so many times, God basically exists in his Trinitarian existence is an interrelational existence founded and based, as John reminds us, in love. And that so forth, therefore, too, in his image and likeness, the human person essentially is a relational person whose totality of personhood is activated in the capacity to love and to be loved. In other words, in a relationship of love with another, with others. And so what happens then is Jesus has now moved this forward from kind of, in a way, the impersonal world into the personal world. But what he has also done, shown the tremendous generosity of God's mercy and God's love, something that he has tried to express before. And when the Pharisees and the scribes whom he encounters challenge him on his hanging out with the wrong kind of people in the wrong kind of places, then he kind of comes back again with this reminder of God's abundance, his abundant goodness. We find this theme of abundance in the multiplication of the loaves and the fishes. We find this theme of abundance in the fishing expedition of Peter and the others when the boats almost sink from the abundance of their catch. This is one thing that Jesus manifests over and over again, is the overflowing and abundant love of the Father for all of those who turn to him. He has that love for those who turn away from him as well, but they do not respond. And Jesus, the Lord, our God, does not manipulate responses. He gives us the freedom to love him or to turn away from him. He gives us the freedom to accept him or to reject him. He gives us the freedom in every way in order that we might then come to him freely, for only in freedom is there authentic love. Only when we freely love the Lord is he loved by us. He loves us freely at all times, but we must respond in that same freedom. That is such a powerful and such an important idea, reality about the human person and the relationship with God. St. Bernard says, for instance, that the highest attribute of the divine is freedom, and therefore the highest attribute of the human person in his image is freedom as well, which Bernard situates within the will. And Bernard says that the will is therefore the highest faculty of the human person, and it is influenced by the ancillary powers of the intellect and the desires and so forth. So it is not a totally irrational entity, and it is not a whimsical entity. It is surrounded by the ancillary powers of the human mind and the human heart, and it is affected by them, so that it is able to make bad choices, because it can become misinformed. But in its highest reality, it is fully knowledgeable about what it does. And fully knowledgeable what it does, because it is in the image and the likeness of the divine. So now the Father's extravagance has shown itself, and the two previous parables of the sheep, of lost sheep and the coin, have now been brought into the fullness of their meaning. No longer is it just, you know, a possession, but now it is a relationship that comes into full blossom when the Son humbly returns to the Father and confesses his sins and asks for forgiveness. The forgiveness of the Father is not, all right, fine, you know, you've been a very, very disgraceful person, so you don't really deserve your original position within the family. What we'll do instead is we'll make you one of the servants where you least have room and board and so forth. This is what the Son expected. This is not what the Son received. We don't know what we expect when we turn back to the Lord. We carry with us, of course, the burdens of the things that we have done wrong. They remain with us as wounds or scars on our souls and on our hearts. But there is no question here either but what he has fully restored. And so this then is the story of the abundant mercy of the Father. And so we could call this the parable of the merciful Father instead of the parable of the prodigal son. But there is another piece to this, and this is directed toward the scribes and the Pharisees. It is directed toward those who serve the Lord out of expectation of reward and not out of care or love for him or for others. This is the very thing that Jesus accuses the scribes and the Pharisees. And there is also, especially in Luke's gospel, a hint of the rejection of Israel and the acceptance of the Gentiles, which is a particularly bitter pill for the people of the Old Covenant to hear from the one who some acknowledge as the Messiah. It is, we have been faithful to you all these hundreds and hundreds of years, and yet now you are reaching out to the unworthy, to the unwashed, to the unclean. And Paul and Peter have the same kind of problem. The early church struggles with this. Should they go to the unclean? Should they go to the unwashed? Are they sent only to the people of Israel? And that becomes then one of the major contributions to the conflicts within the early church, that there is a deep and abiding question about what is the object of the mission, what is the purpose of the mission. So the gospel says, now the elder son was out in the field, and on his way back, as he drew near the house, he could hear music and dancing. And calling one of the servants, he asked him what it was all about. Your brother has come, replied the servant, and your father has killed the calf we had fattened because he has got back safe and sound. the brother was angry then and refused to go in. And his father came out to plead with him, but he answered his father, "Look, all these years I have slaved for you and never once disobeyed your orders. Yet you never offered me so much as a kid for me to celebrate with my friends. But for this son of yours, when he comes back after swallowing up your property, he and his women, you killed the calf we had been fattening." And the father said, "My son, you are with me always, and all I have is yours. But it is only right that we should celebrate and rejoice, because your brother here was dead and has come to life. He was lost and is found." The culmination of the incredible mercy of the Lord. The brother, by inheriting the wealth in the time to come, would have received in many ways an empty gift. The younger son received instead the abundant mercy, kindness, and love of the Father. And for all of us, in each of our lives, materialistic as we are within our society, we know that without human love, there is a poverty among us. Without human love, there is something missing and empty within us. We know that we must experience the love of neighbor, the love of God, be that neighbor in family, among friends, within communities, and so forth. But we need to experience that for us to experience the fullness of our own humanity. And for many, that is a direct love between God and ourselves. For many others, it is a mediated love through those around us. But at any rate, it is ultimately the goal of life, and it is ultimately the purpose of living. For it is the fulfillment of our humanity, and it is the fulfillment of the creation that we have received. Have all the wealth and the fame that we want, have all of that, does not guarantee, therefore, that we become fully human, that we become fully realized the potential of our own humanity within ourselves. We can see that as among many of the rich and the famous. We can see it in the pathetic disasters of the celebrity world. We can find it all over the place of people who seem like Dr. Faust, to have sold their soul for the sake of wealth and success and prestige and all of that kind of thing. At the same time, we know that in the end, as with Faust, it was not acceptable. In the end, it was not enough. In the end, there was grief and sorrow for what had happened in the hollowness and the shallowness. We see many of the rich and the famous clinging to power, clinging to wealth, clinging to influence, all the time growing older and older and weaker, and experience disintegration around them of relationships, of friendships, of family relationships, and so forth. That the younger son, having chosen the way of the world, having chosen the material world, comes to the father not in love and says to you how great it is that you have been so good to my brother, how wonderful it is that he is found, he has come back, he has repented. Certainly we welcome him back into the family. This does not return to him his inheritance. It does not return to him the original gift, but it replaces the original gift of wealth with the gift of infinite and abundant love. And that becomes the most important gift of all. I know sometimes we hear, well, did the younger son, in being received back into the family, did the younger son then also receive his inheritance back? Well, it doesn't tell us that, but that would not be the way of the ancient world. But instead of the inheritance, he received the love of his father. And that, Jesus is saying, is quite enough for us. And that this kind of love, this fulfillment of our own humanity that he has given us, the purgation of the selfishness and the self-seeking and the clinging to things which are not sufficient for us. Again, St. Bernard reminds us that we are imprisoned by falling in love with those things which are inadequate for us. He says to do so is to create within us obsessions and compulsions, that we try to extract from inadequate things what we need, and it is never really enough. And so we find in the story of humanity trying to liberate, wrest themselves free from the living God, seek and cling after those things which the world offers to us as compensation, only to find a certain emptiness, a certain hollowness within our lives, and a certain desperation then. I need more money, I need more sex, I need more drugs, I need more drink, I need more food, I need more fame, I need more, and it goes on and on and on. And never is it enough. Never is it enough. And I think, you know, so often when I think of some of the very, very wealthy entertainment celebrities who are out campaigning for charitable causes, which if they divested themselves of even the majority of their fortune, wouldn't have to ask anyone else for money. But that's not how it works. They try to assuage their feelings of guilt by, in some way, shape, or form, trying to make others feel guilty with them for being inadequate in responding to what they perceive to be the humanitarian needs of our age. It is a form of altruism, which is not the work of the Lord, but which is the work of self-aggrandizement and the work which distorts the gifts given and distorts the results to those causes for which it is given. It's not that those causes might not in themselves be worthy, but when we give for our own sake and not for the sake of the other, some way, shape, or form, we in some way damage the very thing we give to. And that's something like what we're finding in the gospel today, this acquisitiveness, this idea that somehow or other, as if we can, will be willing to suffer for the sake of material gain. This was the elder son. He somehow or other, he never says to the Father, "You never loved me." He never says to the Father, "I loved you." He never says to the Father, "I loved working for you." He never says to the Father, "This life you have given me is wonderful." He never said any of those things to his Father. Instead, he complained about his Father's generosity and abundance of goodness to his brother, who did apparently what this man would have rather have done had he had the opportunity. But material considerations kept him down on the farm. So here we are then with this strange story. The story, the elder son becomes the image of the scribes and the Pharisees. And he also becomes in many ways the image of the recalcitrant people of the old covenant who will not respond to the message of love and forgiveness that comes through the Messiah. And it also shows the extension and the openness of the new proclamation of the new covenant to all the peoples of the earth, especially to those who are in the greatest need. And so as we read this and as we reflect upon this and pray over this, let us put these pieces together in our meditations, in our prayer lives, and ask the Lord that we may, in whatever way possible, have within ourselves the spirit of the repentant Son, in order that we might experience not only the fullness of our own humanity and therefore find contentment, but also experience the abundant love and mercy of a forgiving and a loving God.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.